So, at the end of a 3-week retreat, our minds are pretty simple, pretty quiet. And so I thought we'd start with something very, very simple. And the Buddha's Four Noble Truths, except from the point of view of a 4-year-old. So, sometimes people are sad. Sometimes the things that makes people sad is not getting something we want or getting something they don't want. There's a way to not be sad about not getting what you want or getting something you don't want. The way is to not think so much about what you want, but instead to think about how you can be kind and helpful to your family, your teachers, your friends, other people, animals, bugs, and everything that lives. So, in my teenage years, I was deeply influenced by Guru Nanak. He was the founder of Sikhism. I don't know if I pronounced that, Sikhism, in the 15th century. And he taught that the three pillars of a spiritual life were meditating on the name of God, right livelihood, and selfless service. And in the group that I was involved with, it worked for me because we referred to the name of God as being truth. So the name of God was truth, so that I could work with. So when he was a young man, he worked as a merchant in his family business. And, he was already very deeply into his spiritual life, and he hadn't really become a teacher though yet, and he was trying to be a good son and keep stay at the family business instead of becoming a guru. And so he, at the end of the day, he counted money. And as he was counting the money, he got to the number 13, and which sounded just like one of the names of God. And he went into a trance. And, when he came out of a trance, he realized that, he saw God everywhere. There was no place that he didn't see God. And in that same way, everywhere we look is the Dharma, and everything around us is where the Dharma is in action. And so, we've been in this wonderful, refined container of a retreat, but the Dharma is the whole world. It's a whole lives, every part of our lives. So, in this last full day, maybe some of you are beginning to think ahead a little bit. Maybe you're even thinking about packing or connecting with friends and family, or maybe shopping for food, upcoming responsibilities, or all of it in one sitting for some, right? And some of those thoughts might even be helpful. We may have to, figure out when we're going to do certain things, And maybe there are decisions to be made. But the question is, can we consider what needs to be done without adding anything extra, without leaning into it in a relaxed way? Can we be here now thinking about the future? We all have the skill to pick up things and to set them down. And we've been doing that all month long, right? At the beginning of the retreat, we made a choice to put away all our concerns, all our thoughts, put them aside for the last few weeks. And even though sometimes we had to do it repeatedly to put them aside, We were able to do it quite a number of times, right? So we all know how to do that. The art of daily life, of the practice in daily life, is to develop that flexibility, that ease of setting things up, picking things up and setting them down. Some years ago, I read an interview and of one of the marathon monks of Japan, who they have one of the most grueling competitions in the world, and it's the most physical and mental trainings in the world, and it's called Circling the Mountain. And very few people have ever completed it. I think in like 150 years, 47, not many. And in addition, they meditate regularly and they do calligraphy, but what they're known for is the marathon monks, right? They're known for running. And they've run 1,000 marathons in 7 years. And on the seventh year, they run 50 miles a day and for 100 days, and then they slow down a little bit and only 25 miles a day for another 100 days. So the last monk who completed this, it's probably maybe 20 years ago, he was asked how he could even accomplish such a thing. And he said that when he ran, he didn't do anything extra. He didn't use any muscles, tense any muscles that didn't need to be used those moments. If he was going uphill, the uphill muscles worked. Downhill, the downhill muscles worked. None of the facial muscles that we complain with, or the none of those muscles got activated, and none of the extra things we add in our minds got activated. And this is what we're pointing to in daily life. Can we just do what's really simple, just really simple? We're driving, do we need the muscles to be tense? When we're sitting at the computer, do we need our shoulders by our ears? Yesterday, in a practice discussion, a yogi reminded me of a little story that Jack Kornfield taught about a teaching from Ajahn Chah. And he was walking with Ajahn Chah across the rice by the rice paddies, and with a group of monks, And Ajahn Chah, as was his way, pointed to this really huge boulder, and he said, "Is it heavy?" Jack thought, yeah, just like a Zen master, and we're going to answer, yes, it's heavy. And he said, not if you don't pick it up. So going back to our daily lives, it's helpful at the end of the retreat to really re-engage with our lives gradually. Some of us have started moving around a little bit more today, and we might even feel like a little bit normal, and then we go out into the world and we realize how different it feels, and it's really important. If you've got the some of us don't have that choice, but if you've got the choice to really engage really slowly, really gradually. It's really helpful to really notice the difference between responsibility and our ability to respond to something. They're two different things. maybe we have responsibilities like, where we have to take care of someone. It might be a child, a parent, a friend. We have responsibilities at work. Responsibilities to our own body sometimes that feel like a responsibility. we may have a feel a responsibility to respond to the needs of the suffering world around us in different ways. And there's a really big difference between the idea of responsibility and what we do. And that difference makes all the difference with how much we suffer. So the idea that I have to take care of this person, we try to take care of them for 3 years in one moment. That's pretty heavy. But when we just take care of them, make the meal, wash the sheets, wake up in the middle of the night and tend to them, just this one thing at a time, we show up. It might make we might be tired, we might need support sometimes, but carrying this idea that of a responsibility adds a really heavy weight. One of the things that I found myself, I noticed I was doing a lot, I like to call it the tyranny of the to-do list, those endless to-do lists, and boy, are those heavy? They're really heavy. And and for me, the other thing that would run through my brain, I've got so much to do. It would be like this mantra, my mantra. This is so much to do, so much to do. And that's the idea of responsibility. That's an idea. And it adds nothing useful to our lives. Absolutely nothing. A good example, imagine, you go home, or those of you who are home, you turn on your computer and you decide this is the time to look at email. And lo and behold, there's only one email in your inbox. Okay. So how does that feel? That was, if you didn't hear that, it was impossible. Does it feel different than if there were 50 or 100? Our job is to only attend to one email and not carry the other 49 or 99 around. Just one email. In the karmic stream, the responsibility feels like a weight, like a burden, and we tend to take the identity of, I'm the one who's doing this. I have all this responsibility. I'm the one. In the dharmic stream, responsibility flows. We just respond to what's need to be done. The more wholehearted we do whatever we do, the lighter the responsibility is. The less meaning we add to what we do, the lighter it is. So if we lock, at the end of the retreat, we lock our keys inside the car, and while the car's running, and the idea enters, I just finished a 3-week retreat on mindfulness, and and so what happens? Do we add something to it? Do we add that weight, or we just do what needs to be done? We ask someone else to help who's thinking more clearly. sometimes in my own mind, instead of thinking about choosing between the dharmic stream and the karmic stream, I tend to think of choosing between the dharma and the drama, because that's really how my mind flavors all these little things. It's like, oh, I did this. This reminds me of like the Spanish telenovela, the way the mind works sometimes. They tend to exaggerate the emotions. Every little thing's a drama, and That's the mind. You know, having responsibility in our lives includes being responsible to ourselves, to our own capacity. Our capacity to be available increases with practice. You know, it's easy for us to show up for the challenging things that life brings us. But sometimes, due to old age, sickness, circumstances, all the things that life can bring us, the field in which we are able to be available might get smaller. And sometimes we have to really respect that our capacity to respond the way we may have responded at different times, and to do it in a way that's wholesome for us isn't there. And at those times, we really need to know how to take care of ourselves and set our own boundaries, set out the limitations that we may have at this point in time. So sometimes we might want to simplify our lives. We might want to simplify by narrowing what we want. You know, sometimes life, there's so many things we want to do. You know, so many things sound good. You know, so many things can be exciting, you know. But sometimes just narrowing what we devote ourselves to and making it simple can be something that really nurtures us. I'm not saying that in a way that, you know, in a way that it's not okay to do all sorts of different things, but it's just that sometimes we need to really notice what it is, reflect on what's really wholesome for us, what's really needed for us, instead of going by the habits of a lifetime. And sometimes, you know, we decide we're going to do less, you know, and, you know, one of my really dear friends, she worked really hard in her life, and she was like so happy to be retiring, and she wanted to spend, you know, her years right now, you know, after that, you know, in a contemplative life. She really wanted to be able to devote her time this way. And, you know, life had other ideas, and she ended up raising her grandson instead, her young grandson. So one of the common states that arise when we begin to thinking about the future is the habit of worry. And this is the worry that, not worries that might be based on something real, but the worries that are kind of the unhelpful worries that some of you may have on occasion heard on retreat. You know, it's helpful to remember that worry isn't attracted to a relaxed body. So being close to bodies is a real support. You know, most of you have heard Mark Twain's quote about worry, right? The worst things in my life never happened. In my early work life, I was taking a professional seminar with a well-known, he was a popular speaker, you know, kind of teaching us how to present ourselves professionally. And so he decided he was going to share his very first talk that he ever gave in public. And he said he was really terrified. And, you know, so he took a class on public speaking to, you know, try to get a little more comfortable. You know, and one of the exercises they gave was to, you know, they did a meditation where you kind of went into your place where you're peaceful and comfortable, Yeah, he picked, I think, the beach. So he's like laying on the sand, listening to the surf. This kind of really nice little imaginative, little vision. And then at the same time, once you kind of have it and you're feeling it, you do something to anchor that vision. And so he chose to put his hands in his pockets, so he'd have that accessible when he taught, so if he, put his hands in his pockets, it would just kind of bring a little bit of that peace and relaxation and ease he had. And so, they did little trial talks in the class and, worked, so he was all ready to give, his first public talk. And there were like 60 people in the room, all kind of, looking at him, with wide open eyes. And he started to get a little nervous, and so he put his hands in his pocket, and he relaxed. And he kept talking and talking, and then he realized that everybody was averting their eyes. Nobody was looking at him. They're kind of looking down and looking away, and then, finally somebody was like kind of staring at his crotch, and he realized that, he'd never zipped up his fly. And with your hands in your pockets, it's like kind of you get the idea. To make it really worse, the nightmare of public speaking, he peed. But what's amazing is that he really became a sought-after public speaker. So this is like learning from our foolishness, right? From the things that happen. He allowed it to allowed himself to live through that and be with it. What else was going to happen, right? So the point is that some of the worst things in our life may never happen, but some of the most memorable things in life we probably never imagined. So worry. Don't worry. Someone I knew, her, she was what you call, if people are doing, metta for a difficult person, this is the person at the top of their list. And her whole family felt that way. And she just had one of these personalities that pushed a lot of buttons. And her mother took her to see a psychic, and the psychic sat down with her and closed her eyes, contemplated, and opened her eyes and said to her, just a few words, "You're a teacher's teacher." And her mother told me that story, and really that, it was wonderful. It was a really wonderful teaching, probably to everybody but her. This is how the practice teaches us. It's wonderful to have these beautiful healing periods of peace, but it's really when we get caught, when the things we get caught by that really teach us how to grow. The things we get lost in, those are the things that really make us grow. And everything we get caught by is saying, pay attention. That's all it's saying. So instead of making it wrong that we're lost, oh, pay attention. Pay attention. This is the teaching. When I was a teenager, I felt like life was, really challenging, and I had this idea that if only people would leave me alone, then I'd be happy. If they stopped demanding things from me and wanting things from me, then I'd be happy. So, when I went on my first retreat, it was like, ah, oh, I'm gonna be alone with no demands. How wonderful, until I sat down with my own mind, And the defilements just started coming and coming and coming. And even as my practice grew, you know, I found myself, even with extended periods of peace, my first response to a defilement arising was, oh, not this. Not this, you know. And, you know, or not this again, you know. And until I started really seeing it as my teacher. You know, this is my teacher, you know. Oh, yeah, this too. And, you know, and I've learned to fold it into my practice, all these things in myself that you know, I've hated, you know, I haven't wanted, that shouldn't be there, that ruined my peace, and you know, this too. Now, one of the things that often creates a lack of harmony in relationships, in society, is you probably are, you know this quite well, is clinging to view. And in this wider world, it seems to have become even more polarized, more accentuated, more painful. And so I wanted to address this because, you know, as we go back and enter the world, these are some of the things that, you know, re-enter this is the world, you know, I don't want to say, but re-enter the world, re-enter the rhythms of our daily life, you know. So I think it's something that all of us are meeting these days, you know, and I want to reflect on, you know, how we hold these really these points of view that are so so polarized and so painful in our lives, and so going back to my 20s now, you know, I had a friend who, you know, I used to discuss all, you know, all these like metaphysical things, spiritual things, you know, and he was just getting into Zen, you know, and so we'd get into these, you know, philosophical arguments, you know, and every time we'd get into something juicy and there was some tightness coming in, you know, he would go, the opposite's also true. And it would irritate me so much, you know. But I still appreciate the point, especially more so years later. later I sat with retreat with Joseph Goldstein, you know, and he gave a teaching on letting go of clinging, which was like of clinging to view, and it just didn't land well with me, you know. I just couldn't grab it, you know, what he said. Everything else he said just really resonated, and that was just so difficult. And so I asked, you know, in front of 100 people, you know, I said, you know, I understand that it's just a view and, you know, we're not supposed to cling, but what if you're right? I heard a quote from Banke, 17th century Zen master, you know, he said, in an argument, don't side with yourself. So, you know, the problem, what I eventually understood, is that it's not having a view. Having a view is not an issue. The problem is clinging to it. The problem is contracting our hearts. When we contract our hearts, when we're with someone who has a different view, you know, we lose connection. You know, there's no longer a human being there. There's just a view, just an empty view. But it's important to really notice how painful clinging to view is. In particular, for so many of us, views about politics, environment, health, all these views, I see people get really contracted over Dharma, including myself in the past. And if we do find ourselves lost, where we're clinging to view with the energy of like, a dog with a bone, I don't know if you can relate to clinging to view that way, really get the pain of that, really get the suffering of that, and meet it with kindness in ourselves. It's dukkha, we're suffering when we do that. And any time we're feeling burdened, we're caught in painful ideas, freedom is close. It's just so close. We see that. It's just a moment of knowing what's going on, knowing, sensing, relaxing into it. It's right there for us, that freedom. Whether it's a responsibility, whether it's a view, whether it's a worry, it's right there for us. And just a couple of quotes. You've probably all heard the inspiring quote from Mahatma Gandhi, which is kind of in the opposite, it's also true category. Live as if you're going to die tomorrow, and learn as if you're going to live forever. Right? Live as if you're going to die tomorrow, and learn as if you're going to live forever. And I adapted it for my own practice, and practice as if I'm going to die tomorrow, and also practice as if I have all the time in the world. And I was also taught practice as if your hair's on fire, but I never found the ability to relax with that one. So I'm going to end with a short poem by Leonard Cohen that one of the yogis asked me to remember. And it's called Roshi, and he wrote it in relation to his teacher. I never really understood what he said, but every now and then I find myself barking with the dog or bending with the irises or helping out in other little ways. And let's share a minute of silence. Thank you.